Today is June 22nd, 2016, and this is episode number 365 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, the most high-maintenance person you've ever met in your life. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com. Jeff, my stylus moved without a courtesy call.
And just so everyone's clear on this, in case there's any issue with the headphones that you're using, not stylus, like for your iPad, stylist, like the person that makes Brian's hair as beautiful as it is.
As it's going to be.
No, your hair is actually really awesome.
Okay, we'll leave that on the table for now. The point is, she's been cutting my hair for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Right? These are not cheap haircuts. This is not going to Supercuts.
Right. And she left and didn't say a word.
Didn't say a word. I find out on Instagram.
So this is like if you guys had been a couple for 3 years and you're living together and you come home one day and she's just gone and you don't know why she left.
It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same thing as if we were a couple. Yeah, she owes me that level of I'm not that high maintenance.
No, you're not that high maintenance.
I am high maintenance. But I'm not, I mean, like the salon at least should have called.
Yeah, it is really weird that you didn't get any sort of communication from her or from the haircutting place you go.
You know, this actually could be my fault because I've gotten fewer haircuts since I let it grow out.
Oh, so maybe this is passive aggressive on her part.
Well, no, and she actually moves salons. And I haven't actually been to the new salon. So, all right, so fine. The new salon doesn't owe me a phone call. That's fine.
Now, when you told me this before the show,
did I leave that part out?
You left that part out.
Well, she knows that I haven't like stopped being her client. I just don't get haircuts as often.
No, apparently you have stopped being her client.
Well, yeah. I just didn't know it.
No, you didn't get the memo.
That's a fair point.
So, up until the point where you dropped the extra piece about how you haven't been to the new salon, all I could think was, this is just a really crappy thing to do. Now I'm thinking it's just unprofessional on the part of your stylist. She should have at least sent you a text or an email. I mean, she didn't need to come over for, you know, to cry together about how it's not you, it's her, and all of that. But just like a note, like, hey, moving to Portland or Seattle or Tacoma, wherever she went.
Well, we have texted before. She could have texted me.
Yeah,
what I'm saying.
She could have texted you.
Like I say, I'm. I could be high maintenance. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, now we have a new problem, and that's your hair, because we need to find someone to take care of it for you the way you deserve.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always, in the 10 years that I've been seeing what used to be my new girl.
We'll refer to her as your ex.
I felt like I was cheating on my actual stylist in Austin. This is a true story, by the way. I'm not just saying that.
For
10 years, I've lived in another state and had a new stylist. And every single time I go to see her, I would feel like I was cheating on my original stylist.
So in that sense, she was done being the other woman.
Yeah.
You are kind of high maintenance, but I love you.
I am so high maintenance, man. I am so.
But now what are we going to do? We need to find you someone that can treat your hair in the way that you deserve and have become accustomed, and is not going to sneak away in the middle of the night. And
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Manner that I've. To which I've become accustomed.
Yeah.
I deserve this.
Anywho. So if we have any listeners left.
And you know someone in the Bay Area that would be awesome for Brian's hair.
Did you watch the interview with Phil Schiller and Craig Federighi that John Gruber did for the talk show Live?
I watched parts of it. I didn't have time to sit through the whole thing. Because I was really worried about your hairdresser, but,
sure.
Yeah. But I've seen parts of it. I've seen the important parts.
How do you know?
Because I read your article.
Ah, that's really clever what you did there.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's all right. So, it's a very good interview. I strongly recommend, you should actually probably listen to it instead of listening to us because, you know, I'm going to spend time talking about my hair, which, you know, Mr. Gruber didn't actually do, but anyway, it's a really good interview. Phil Schiller, Craig Federighi. It's Phil Schiller, of course, is Apple's senior vice president and marketing. And I forget his actual title and, apparently too lazy to look it up. And then Craig Federighi is the senior vice president in charge of Apple's software, both iOS, macOS, I guess technically watchOS and tvOS too, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep, I believe that is correct.
He's got people. He's got.
You should call Craig. Tapes. Ask who does his hair.
That's true. That man has good hair.
Yeah, his hair is epic.
Yeah, although it turns out it's the second best hair at Apple. We thought it was the best hair at Apple.
That's true because Bose has the best hair at Apple.
Yes, and did we make that little crack already?
I don't know if we made a joke, but we did note that she has the best hair at Apple, so this is really interesting because some of the best hair we have ever seen is all at Apple.
It's true.
So yeah, there's Bose, there's Craig Federighi and Chris Breen.
And Chris Breen. Yeah. He's got the third best hair. We thought it was the second, but.
And still third best hair. The bar is set very, very high.
Yes. Yes, it is. But anyway, so Craig, great interview. Good interview. And so it's a little over an hour and 15 minutes. And I went through it and I gathered the six things that I thought were, six things that I learned mm-hmm. from the interview.
I would love to know what those are, Brian.
Well, you already know, but thanks for playing along. This is the straight man. I appreciate that. The first thing was that when you remove a stock Apple app in iOS 10, which is like this is going to be the first time that we're able to do that, right?
Yes.
What Apple is doing is removing your user data and then removing the hooks that the rest of iOS has into that app and vice versa. So, for instance, if you were to remove the Contacts app, which would be a weird one for you to remove, but whatevs.
You're right.
If you were to remove the Contacts app, Siri would no longer think about contacts when you were wanting to look someone up.
So, it would be sort of like Dory, where it just no longer remembers?
Well, yeah. Assumingly, of course, you had some other kind of contact app that you replaced it with in iOS 10. Because those are things that you're going to be able to do.
Sure.
But the app itself doesn't get deleted. The user data gets deleted, the hooks get deleted, and then its presence on your home screen gets deleted, but the apps themselves don't. And Apple made a point of stressing that that all of its apps, I think, are 110 megabytes. So they're not taking up a lot of space.
Yeah. I thought it was... If you deleted all of the apps that you can, it only saves 150 megabytes of space. And that's because most of what the apps are is actually built into the operating system.
Yeah, that sounds more accurate than my version.
Okay, we'll go with that.
So anyway, the apps are still there. Now, here's the other thing. So Apple is moving. This is, again, this is all on iOS 10, which is going to be released this fall. Mm-hmm. And just looks amazeballs to me.
Yeah.
You to reinstall those apps, you're going to go to the App Store. So like Apple Stocks app will be on the App Store, and, you know, presumably Contacts and, you know, whatever. All the apps that you can remove will be on the App Store. And when you go to reinstall them, it's not actually reinstalling them.
Mm-hmm.
The App Store is going to tell your iOS device, hey, reactivate those hooks and prepare for some user data.
Now, I find this absolutely fascinating, because what Apple's doing is taking what amounts to a system setting and turning it into an App Store experience, as opposed to just giving us a setting somewhere in system preferences on our system settings on our iPhones, where we can go in and say, hide this app, hide this app, hide this app.
Well, you know, that's true, but I think it actually works the way we think about stuff. I think this is actually more consistent with the user experience than it is with the fundamental realities underlying that user experience.
I agree. It feels very weird to me, but I think that it's because I'm approaching this from someone that looks at these sort of things not so much from the average user's perspective, but more from the perspective of someone that's been steeped in this technology for longer than some countries have existed. Wait, that's a long-winded way of saying I'm using engineering think about this instead of human think, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of. Yes, kind of. And I think that Apple should get a lot of credit for actually thinking about this from the user experience standpoint, because they could have done just what you said. They could have been a setting under system settings. But who's going to go looking there to reactivate these apps if they don't already know that it's there? If they didn't happen to see it or just, you know, have read about it or whatever, no one's going to go looking for there. You might go looking on the App Store. I think most people would go looking.
Yeah, and the average person, if they want to make an app go away, they don't think to go to settings. They do the firm press or the long press so that all their icons jiggle, and then tap the little X to make them go away.
Yeah.
So as we're talking through this, it's making a lot more sense to me where they're doing it the way they are.
Oh, you give Apple credit? That's nice of you. It's big.
Well, you know, sometimes they get it right.
Yeah. All right, so anyway, I found all of that cool. Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Got notes in the show notes if you want to go see this for yourself. There's another thing, something that we actually talked about here and on TDO, and that was the search ads that are going to be in the App Store.
Yeah, search ads. That's one of those things that I'm cautiously optimistic about.
Well, we were concerned at the time. We at least at the very least, I expressed specific concern about the ability of big developers to shut out small developers.
Yes, and since we've learned more since our original discussion, I have moved into the cautiously optimistic camp.
Fair enough. I like that. And specifically, it turns out that the people running Apple are pretty good at what they do.
Yeah, and how about that?
One of so at least to hear Phil Schiller, and Phil Schiller is in charge of the App Store now,
mm-hmm.
right? So to hear him tell it, they wanted search ads, they designed search ads to be with a small developer in mind. So starting with, there's no minimum bid. Right, so you don't have to have $1 million. If you remember, do you remember the when iAd rolled out?
Mm-hmm. That was right. Really expensive.
You had to spend like a million. You know, if you weren't spending $1 million, Apple wouldn't talk to you.
Right.
And I think that was Steve Jobs' Ubers, to be honest.
That wouldn't surprise me in retrospect.
Is it hubris or ubris?
I've always said hubris.
I've always said hubris too. So Steve Jobs, hubris.
Yet with both of us saying it, that's what it is.
Yep, you do pronounce the...
You pronounce the...
Mostly pedantic. So I think that a lot of it was Steve Jobs' hubris. He was so convinced that he could do ads better than everybody else. And to be fair, the iAds that Apple first rolled out were actually some of the best. Were probably not some of the best. They were the best mobile apps I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But that platform largely failed.
Right. So the ads we're seeing now are no different than what I would expect to see from any other platform, really.
Yeah. And so anyway, but there's going to be no minimum bid. So if you have a few dollars to spend, you can spread those few dollars as you want to, which is good for small developers.
Yeah. And there's no prioritization. So it's like a lottery.
Well, it's they use a weighting system, and the price you pay per ad does get weighted. But relevance is weighted higher than bid price.
Okay.
And that is huge for small developers.
Yes.
Right? So, it keeps the deep pockets from just being able to buy all the presents.
Which is good.
That with a CE, not a TS.
Ah. Presents. I see what you did there.
You will be able to buy keywords. So, for instance, I could, if I was doing a street sign app, I could buy Frommer's as a keyword. In other words, so like I'm doing like a guide to street signs in Spain.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I could buy Frommer's, or I could buy Lonely Planet.
Now, other people can buy those keywords as well, right?
Yeah, that's just it. You can buy someone else's branded keywords. But Apple thinks that this will actually benefit small developers more than large developers, because the large developers are probably not going to be trying to buy. There's nothing really for them to buy from a small developer, right? Small developers don't have big brands. That's why they're small.
Right.
So Apple's allowing that, but they think that it will benefit smaller developers more.
Which is okay, I think.
Yeah, I do think that's okay, because let's say that I am making a Frommer's competitor.
Okay.
I'm doing my own travel guides. I want to get my ad in front of people who are looking for Frommer's or Lonely Planet. And, I think there is some legitimacy there. Yeah, I think there's some legitimacy there.
Yeah, if I were making the street sign app that you're talking about, mm-hmm. Yeah, I would want to buy keywords for Frommer's, Lonely Planet, and Rick Steves.
Well, but even if I was going to make Brian Chaffin's High Maintenance Guide to Traveling,
mm-hmm.
I would want to get my app in front of the people searching for those other apps, because I don't have any name recognition.
True. Yeah, that makes sense.
That'd be a great travel guide, by the way.
I'd read the crap out of that.
All right, so also, you can't buy exclusivity.
This is the part that makes me very happy.
So that keeps, and not to pick on Frommer's, I happen to be a fan, and of Lonely Planets. I don't know Rick Steve.
Oh, you should watch his stuff. He's really smart.
I'm making that a given. I'm a fan of all these people, but again, using this as an example, it would keep Frommer's from going out and buying an exclusive on searches for Frommer's, no matter how much I pay or how much they pay.
They can't do that.
Or how about an exclusive on travel?
All travel, right. Right, they can't do that either. So these are all like... These are, and of course, we also know that it's going to be one ad per search, and it's going to be very clear that it's an ad. Those were big concerns that I had. Like I was definitely concerned that Apple would try to slip in paid search results into the search results.
Have you seen any screenshots of the paid ads? Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty good the way they've done it. So. All of the apps that show up for you, they have a white background. The paid ad has a light blue background, and then it also has in blue text, so like much darker blue text, so it stands out. And it says paid ad. So, see, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's good. That's as it should be. That is absolutely as it should be.
Yeah.
And this is an area that I actually give Google some credit to also for the Google search engine, at the very least, it's very clear where the ads are and where the search results are.
Yeah, I like that too. Now, that said, there are a lot of people that get Google search results and have no idea that some of what they're looking at are placed ads, even though it's very clear.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much you can account for, though.
That's true.
So there's only so much that Google's responsible for. They're not trying to obfuscate anything. And and our longtime listeners know that I'm Google's biggest critic. I'm not going to be their critic on this particular issue.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And I think they've done a good job of making it clear, but there is a percentage of users that just won't get it. And so what that tells me is there will be a percentage of users that complain that they didn't realize they were looking at paid ads in their app store searches.
And that's possible.
Yeah. And that's, I'm not saying that as a negative thing towards Apple. It's just how people are. There's a lot of people out there that just don't get it.
True. All right. Next thing. Ready? Shall we move on?
I'm ready.
Do you know that cool unlock thing so that when you get your Apple Watch, if it's on your wrist and it's activated, mm-hmm. and you get it near your
laptop,
Mac,
uh-huh.
it'll unlock for you?
Yes.
Love that, right?
Yes. I'm looking forward to playing with that.
It turns out that Apple thought about security when they were setting that up.
I'm not surprised, but enlighten me.
So they're doing speed of light checks over Wi-Fi for how long it takes signals to basically the signal from like your Apple Watch to your Mac.
Now, this is something I'm really interested seeing in action because they said we're doing speed of light, which is really cool.
Speed of light checks.
Yes, but they're doing it over Wi-Fi. So there's a lot that they have to take into account. And because you're going to have latency because you're going through a Wi-Fi network for all of this.
That's not really the point, though. I mean, latency is all figured out in the test. But the mm-hmm. issue here is preventing someone from hijacking or relaying the signal from your Apple Watch and using it to unlock your Mac when you're not actually there.
Yeah, that is really cool.
And I mean, and so, yeah, there are delays because while radio travels, the radio signals travel at speed of light, right?
Sure. But once they hit the network, the speed of light is gone.
Right, exactly. But Apple knows that, and so that's included in the test that they're doing.
Right. So my point is, I'm curious to see how effectively Apple has dealt with that.
Yeah, it seems like they move the speed of light, right? Yeah, but they don't get processed at the speed of light. I guess that's the best way to put it.
Right.
Right. So yeah. Anyway, so this limits the opportunity for shenanigans on the part of a malicious actor.
Which is good.
Yes, it is very, very good. Let's see now, the little tiny thing
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember deep learning?
Yes.
For photos, deep learning analysis.
Yes.
This is where Apple is doing a crap ton of calculations to determine that this is, say, a photo of a mountain, or this is a mountain, or this is a horse. That was, those were the two examples they used.
It's like 11 million calculations.
Yeah, I think it's 11 billion.
11 billion. Well, that would be more. A lot more.
A lot more, yeah. 11 billion calculations per photograph. Now,
and that's happening locally.
It's all happening locally. Apple is not doing this by taking the photograph, uploading it to the cloud, doing the analysis, and spitting the results back. As a matter of fact, that's how Apple is doing most of its machine learning for our benefit. They're doing it locally.
You know, I think a lot of people forget that when they have an iPhone in their pocket, they're carrying an incredibly powerful computer around. And it's clearly a very capable computer because you can take a photograph and in real time, there will be 11 billion calculations that are processed on that photo to identify faces and other objects.
Yeah, the app, it's going to be doing facial recognition too, but it's not facial recognition because Google knows that that's Susie. It's facial recognition because you have told your iPhone that this is Susie, and your iPhone will be able to say, well, if that's Susie, then this is Susie.
Right. I wonder if Apple has finally overcome the problem that made back in the day iPhoto, and now photos give up for me, and it's that my mom's an identical twin. And so...
No, how will they solve that?
Well, what they need to solve is a thing so that it stops trying to identify that person and just to, so what happened to me was photos got very confused trying to understand what I meant when I would say this person's my mom, this person's my aunt, and eventually it refused to identify either of them or recognize either of them anymore.
Well, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, so I actually can't put my mom or my aunt into photos. Well, into the facial recognition part. So I can't even call them the same person now. Photos is like, nope, the person doesn't exist. And I'm like, wow, that's got to really be an ego blow to my mom. And, well,
it's a tad bit of an outlier. And I think it's probably the least problem that identical twins run into in life.
Yeah, I'm sure there are bigger issues they run into.
So anyway, this deep analysis stuff, right? So Apple's doing all this stuff locally. Now, your iPhone is actually fast enough to do these 11 billion calculations live when you're taking a new photo.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Which is crazy, right? But if you have a bunch of photos already on your phone, your iPhone's going to have to process under iOS 10. This is all happening under iOS 10. iOS 10 is going to have to process those.
Yeah, at some point.
In a large batch.
Mm-hmm.
And if it tried to do so while you're walking down the street,
Your pants would probably explode.
Exactly. And not in a fun way.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. It would be, you know, the iPhone would become like, you know, molten salt.
Oh, we learned about that.
Yeah. I don't know why it would become salt, but whatever. Just work with me here. And instead, Apple will wait for that batch processing. And this obviously will only have to be done once.
Mm.
And they specifically said it would be done when you're plugged in on AC overnight.
So that's pretty cool.
Yes. That is very, very smart. So, you know, you'll wake up and your phone might still be warm, but those.
But at least your pants didn't explode.
But your pants didn't explode. All right. So then we also have an interesting thing. I was very interested in this. You remember how Apple opened up Siri to developers?
Mm-hmm.
But it did so in only six categories of apps.
Right.
And it's like, you know, well, why? And it turns out because of the way Apple is doing stuff. So one of the things, and you and I have, I know that we've talked about this. I've talked about it on TDO with you. Talked about it here. I think I talked about it on the Tech Night Owl with Gene Steinberg. It's like, I've written about it too. You know, Apple is kind of, it's like, how is it that Apple's competitors are leapfrogging Apple when it comes to things like vocal control, like, you know, Cortana and Amazon Echo and whatnot? Mm-hmm. They seem more capable than Siri in some ways.
Yeah, they do.
And Apple was out of the gate before anybody else on this stuff. So according to, now, of course, this is their spin, and it could just be a spin. But what they implied without specifically stating is that these competing devices are adding functionality essentially with cheap cheats. For instance, adding keyword triggers so that when Amazon Echo hears a keyword, it's going to hand off the next string of words that are said to some kind of a helper app or a third-party app.
Oh, okay.
And that's less about Amazon Echo or Alexa understanding what you're saying and simply just sort of being a, you know, a robot go-between.
And what Apple wants is something that can be more interactive and actually understand what you're saying and not just simply be a conduit to another app.
Right. And so what Apple has done is they sort of divided things into what they call domains. The example they use, and this is definitely a part that I recommend you go listen to because this is really, really interesting. They used chat apps as an example. So okay. You know, one of the things you're going to be able to do in iOS 10 is you're going to be able to say, when I tell you to send a message to this particular person, I want you to use WeChat, or I want you to use Line, or I want you to use WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. Right. And Apple, your device will do that. Siri will do that for you. And this is a huge change that is going to greatly increase the utility value of your iPhone or iPad, in my opinion, at the very least.
Yeah, I agree. If they get this right, it makes Siri far more powerful because it can actually respond to what you're really saying and not just trigger off of keywords.
Right. So one of the example that Craig Federighi was using was if you say something like WeChat Phil, well, what does that mean?
Well,
you and I know what that means because we have human brains. Mm-hmm. We know that means send Phil a message via WeChat.
Right.
Which is the name of an app.
Right. So I'm assuming that if, say, Amazon's Echo got that command and could do things on your computer, then all it would know is to launch the Wemo app. Not Wemo, WeChat app.
WeChat app, and then hand it whatever string was set after WeChat.
Yeah.
So what Apple is instead doing is they took the quote-unquote domain of chatting, and they have focused on teaching Siri to understand everything about chatting, so that when Siri hears a command like WeChat Phil, it knows that what you actually mean is, hey, I want you to send Phil a message, but I want you to do it using the WeChat app.
Yeah, that's a lot more useful.
It's a lot more useful. And it means, you know, some slower going, but it also means better going. And it certainly provides a better foundation in the future. So Apple, those first six categories of apps are because those are six domains that Apple has taught Siri to understand. And I think both Craig and Phil during the interview said that more domains will come.
Okay, so they're teaching more.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
now.
These are just the first six.
These are just the first six.
All right. Well, that's cool. This gives me hope for Siri.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives me a ton of hope for Siri's future.
And, a ton of hope. Yeah, and it sounds like Apple has found a way around the problem that's been holding them back in some ways, which is that they're not mining all of our data.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, that was actually another little tidbit. I didn't include this in the article, but they talked about how they talked specifically about the lack of need of uploading your photos to the cloud. They said, it turns out there are other photographs of mountains out there. So we were able to find some photographs of mountains so that we could teach the Photos app what a photograph of a mountain looked like. And we didn't need to do that by taking our customer photos and uploading them to the cloud.
That's just crazy talk.
Isn't that just crazy just talk?
Using publicly available resources like that.
Yeah, and it might have been actually it'd be funny if they just did a Google
search for mountains.
Image search. I doubt they did it that way. I imagine they probably and this is pure speculation on my part, but they probably used a professional photo service of some sort so that they could do everything from a licensed and legal standpoint.
Probably.
So yeah, that is an interesting solution to the thing that I have identified a problem, and that's that, you know, Apple needs more access to our data to make to make Siri and its artificial intelligence more useful.
So it turns out that what Apple really needs is access to certain types of data that it doesn't necessarily have to get from us.
Correct. From its customers, yeah.
That's really cool.
All right. So the sixth thing that I learned, super interesting. Turns out Apple's been sandbagging when it comes to the Apple Watch.
I was really surprised to hear this too. And then at the same time, not.
Well, once we heard it, it kind of seems obvious in retrospect, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I even speculated as much around the time of WWDC.
Right. So, by the way, yeah. I wish I'd mentioned this on TDO with John. John has this fantasy that Apple is going to add battery life to Apple Watch.
Well, this is an ongoing fantasy for him.
Yeah, it's because, but it's he wants Apple to add battery life, and so, but he turns that into therefore he thinks Apple will. And I maybe I've laughed at him for saying that, and this makes me even more sure that the next Apple Watch is going to be smaller and offer the same battery life.
Sure. Yeah. They can actually cut out battery, but still give us the same span because, as you said, they've been sandbagging with Apple Watch. They've
been sandbagging. And where this matters is watchOS 3, which was also shown during the keynote. We talked about watchOS 3 a little bit. But, man, watchOS 3, my quip during the keynote was that this may finally bring Apple Watch alive or make it come to life.
Right.
I forget how I said it. And I just saw so many interesting and neat aspects of Apple Watch during the Apple Watch 3 demo. And it's like, oh man, wow, finally this is going somewhere. And then Dave Hamilton made the observation, well, if this is going to work on the first generation of Apple Watch, which is the app, you know, the only version still being sold, mm-hmm. Why was watchOS 1 and 2 even released?
And that was when I speculated that Apple was holding back because they didn't know how people would use the devices and how and what sort of effect or impact that would have on battery life.
Right. And that's exactly what Craig Federighi and Phil Schiller were saying during this interview, is that they didn't use the word sandbagging. I used that word, but they said that they hobbled what the Apple Watch could do
because they were overly conservative on what they allowed Apple Watch to do, because they were concerned about battery life until they actually had data on how people used it.
And now they have over a year of data.
Right.
And they've learned a lot.
This is a quote. He said, this is Craig Federighi, said, quote, "We found that we actually really overshot the goal, which was an area of just massive focus to paranoia through the release," unquote. So now that they understand that, that's part of why watchOS 3 is going to be so much more capable than watchOS 1 and 2.
Which is really cool. And I've been wondering, and I've speculated at times, about Apple giving us a lot of new functionality without having to replace the hardware for Apple Watch. I mean, we know we have sensors in Apple Watch that are just shut off. And, I mean, they're not being used at all. So we have that, and now we have the confirmation that Apple was intentionally hobbling Apple Watch to preserve battery life. I'm expecting watchOS 3 to be like getting a brand new watch.
Yeah, I think it's going to feel that way. I think it's going to feel that way, and I think that Apple Watch 2, the next version of the Apple, whatever they call it, is going to look a lot sexier than Apple, the first Apple Watch. I think it's going to be a much better form factor. Now, I may be projecting there because I don't like the form factor of Apple Watch. It's part of my whole, I like this thing, but I don't love it. Functionality is part of that. Functionality is the biggest part of that, but form factor is also a part of it.
Yep, I get that. Now, for me, one of the biggest things about Apple Watch that changed was getting a different band, and I found that polyblastic band, whatever, the plastic band, it's fine, but
can we say that on the show?
Yeah, we can say fine.
Go ahead.
Anyhow, I like my Apple Watch a lot more with a different band on it. And I had to get a third-party leather loop band because I have a 38-millimeter watch. And Apple doesn't make this band for this size watch.
Yeah, is it holding up? That was all, you know, Dave is all about, oh, man, we can get this stuff off of what?
Alibaba.
Alibaba, yeah, we can get this stuff for a lot less. Like, yeah, but is it really the same quality? I kind of doubt it.
No, it's not the same quality at all. And okay. So I've had my band for 6 months now.
Mm-hmm.
And I, a couple months ago, had to glue back together where the leather was peeling apart to expose the magnetic pieces inside. And I actually, just a couple of days ago on Amazon, I ordered the same band again, because it's to the point now where I'm like, yeah, you know, I can keep gluing stuff together, but I just don't feel like doing it. So I'll spend another $17 and just get a new band.
Right. Now, essentially, you get what you pay for.
Right. Now, other bands, like the knockoff Milanese loop bands, those, from what I hear, are holding up a lot better.
Okay, that could well be. I did see. I went to the new during WWDC. I went to the new Apple store in San Francisco, and I looked at one of the. I don't know. It may have been the Polymaster one you're talking about.
Uh huh.
And I definitely thought it looked good. Yeah, I should get another Apple Watch. I should get a new strap. Maybe I'll like it more. Anywho, little rabbit holing there. Good interview. You should go and watch it if you haven't already watched it. You could just read through the transcript, which I more posted. I've got a link to that in the article that we'll have in the show notes.
I would need to point out that you did something really cool in your article, which is give people the string of words that they need to search for to jump right to the part in the transcript that hits each of the topics that you covered.
Yeah, thanks. There weren't any anchors or anything in the Ironwork piece, so I just figured out what unique set of letters I could type into a find to find it. So, like, one of them is in the cont, C-O-N-T. Like, you don't need to type more than that to find... what's part was that?
I do not know. I don't
that
have...
That was for the unlock feature.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a cont. C-O-N-T will take you right to the part where they're talking about that. Yeah, anyway, so some find shortcuts to help you out. Oh, you know what? I need to go back in and add the timestamps for the video for the same
Oh, that would be handy.
Yeah, that I should have already done that. Kind of forgot about it. Right. So, Gooey Duck. I've been mispronouncing his name forever.
Yeah, Gooey Duck.
It's because it's spelled Geoduck.
Right, but pronounced Gooey Duck.
It's Gooey Duck, yeah. Longtime member of the Mac Observer.
Which is awesome.
He listened to, did he listen or write or read?
He watched.
Oh, right. You did a video thing.
You know, you had three options, and you didn't even guess the right one.
I didn't even include the right one.
No.
It's one of those options. So he watched your video piece
on chair glass
formats.
Yeah. You know, to sit under your chair at your desk.
Right.
Yeah. And he really liked the idea, so we collectively as TMO, me individually as the person that made the video, we inspired him to create his own high quality chair mat to go under his desk chair. But he didn't do glass. He used wood that was reclaimed from construction projects. And what he made is it's like a mini hardwood floor. And it sits under his office chair and it looks great. It's just so cool.
Yeah, it looks fantastic, and he made it for I think $45.
Yeah, and in comparison, the glass mat that's under my chair is about $200.
Yeah, a lot more expensive.
A lot more expensive, but
and he had some ways to actually save some money even over the $45.
Right. And none of those involve breaking the law and actually stealing materials, which is great.
That's true. That would be another way to save, quote unquote, save money. The result is just fantastic. And I love that your piece on glass mats inspired him to do that in the first place, and I love even more the fact that he could do it.
Yeah, it's absolutely awesome. I think it's wonderfully cool that he found the inspiration to do something awesome like that and then did it. I feel like I have made a difference in this world now.
Yeah, fair enough. One chair mat at a time, yeah. So let's see here. I do the Twitter tweets.
Do you?
I do, yeah. I do the Twitter thing. I do the Twitter thing at TMO Brian. It's Brian with a Y.
Yeah. What sort of things do you talk about on the Twitter thing?
I do technology stuff occasionally. And I talk about writing the fiction world. Occasionally, yeah.
Sometimes you talk about your own book that you have been working on and hopefully
shopping out to an agent. Mm-hmm. Any agents that are listening right now looking for sci-fi, feel free to drop me a note.
It's a good book. I've read it in many forms. It's a good book.
You've read it in forms that were not so good. I very rarely tweet about politics. So if you don't want to see any politics, don't follow me, TM O'Brien, on the Twitter.
Yeah. Hey, I'm on the Twitter thing also.
Do tell.
Yeah, I'm Jay Gamet.
Jay Gamet, yep.
And I think my Twitter stream is more of a random dump of whatever just happens to be in my head at the moment. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah. No, you're really good at social networking, the social media thing. You're really, really good at it. You are much better at it than I am, for instance, and you're actually much better at it than a lot of people. Yeah. So if I were listening to this right now, and I had room in my life for precisely one more Twitter feed, but no more, I'd absolutely follow Jay Gamet rather than me.
That's like the one of the nicest things anyone's ever said.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely true. You're much better at the social media than me.
Well, sometimes it seems like a stream of consciousness that that I cannot control. Take that for whatever you will.
Fair enough. So I'm TM O'Brien, and Jeff is Jay Gamet, and we're on the Twitter. And then there's differential privacy.
Yeah, which we are not doing on our Twitter accounts.
Nope. No, we're not. As a matter of fact, we are scarcely qualified to discuss the issue, so we're going to do just that.
Perfect, because we're professionals.
Right. Differential privacy is something Apple cited during the WWDC keynote.
Yeah, and it's kind of a big thing, but... Wait. Brian, what's differential privacy, and why should I care?
Well, differential privacy is a method of gathering data for machine learning in such a way as to
keep us anonymous.
To make people anonymous. Now, one of the things, actually, again, going back to the video, the interview with Craig Federighi and Phil Schiller, they talked about this a little bit. Their example was the idea of anonymizing data is a bit of a sham. So Google anonymizes a lot of the information that Google collects on us is anonymized, theoretically. But, and I can't remember if it was Craig or Phil that was talking about this, but whichever one it was said, they say that it's anonymous, but you know, they happen to have the device ID, and they happen to have the location where the information was gathered. So
it's really not that anonymous.
It's not really anonymous at all. What differential privacy is, and this is not something Apple made up. Actually, this was another quip they had in the piece. They said if we were naming it, we would have come up with a better name. But
of course,
this is basically, you know, this is not a theory is not the right word. This is something that's been developed outside of Apple, and so it's the idea of breaking up data, but then throwing random noise into that data in such a way that only a little bit of your data is collected and never used. And the point of this would be, for instance, again, I'm using their example here. There's some new phrase or word that's trending, and they want iMessage to know that this word is trending so that iMessage can, for instance, stop trying to correct the spelling.
Makes sense.
So using differential privacy, Apple's servers, because this is going into the cloud, this is information being gathered and going into the cloud and processed, they can pick out new words that are being used, but they're picking it out essentially out of the noise.
Okay, so if everyone that's listening to the show decides that exploding pants are the thing that they really need to talk about, then what Apple would see is that the term, excuse me, exploding pants is trending. Not that Jeff, Brian, and Neil, and Terry, and everyone else were using that term.
Yeah, it's more like they have a sea of noise, and then exploding pants would be one of the things that, that might stand out.
Okay.
From that sea of noise. And this is definitely, and I mean, this is, okay, this, I'm going to get this out, I promise. I think.
I believe in you, Brian.
Your faith may be ill-founded.
No, it's all right. You've got like 5 minutes to get it out, so plenty of time.
Their example was chat specific.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to apply this to other forms of machine learning and other applications of that machine learning. But it, within the context of improving spell checking, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
This, I mean, it's obvious how useful this could be, and it should, to me, it's obvious. So maybe it's not obvious to everybody, but it's also obvious how they can do this without amassing dossiers on us. Matter of fact, they using this method, because the noise is injected at the local level.
Okay.
Right. There's no way for them to compile a dossier, even if they wanted to. Okay. Right? Which, and this is what what Google does is amass a dossier on us, as what Facebook does. It's what Twitter's doing. It's what everybody else is doing besides Apple. They amass a dossier on us, and they you know, and then they sell that to advertisers. And this is not what Apple's doing. This is, you know, this is one of those reasons why I love Apple and why I love Apple's products. And this is the first time that we have learned that Apple is using this branch of machine learning, this branch of data gathering. I don't have the nomenclature. I don't know how to apply the nomenclature here. This is the first time we've learned that this is what Apple is doing, and it's super reassuring. And it's super reassuring in part because we know that Apple is working on this stuff. That Apple is committed to better machine learning, but is also committed to improving that machine learning while still remaining true to its principles of protecting our privacy.
So basically what it comes down to is the notion that we have to give up our privacy in order to have useful information served to us by our computers is wrong.
Ooh, got to put a caveat in there.
Okay.
Apple's got to prove it still. Apple's got to prove that it can make iOS and Siri and Proactive as useful as what Google is doing with Google Now. And I actually still have my doubts. But if Apple can close that gap, there were a lot of things we saw in iOS 10 where Apple is closing that gap between Google Now and some of the most excellent features of Android. Mm-hmm. Where there is a gap, Apple is closing that gap with iOS 10. But Apple still has to actually do it and prove to us that it works.
So what I'd like to think is that Apple being behind in the in this knowledge race is not a sign of incompetence or lack of vision, but instead is Apple moving at a very cautious pace to protect privacy.
Yes. In a nutshell.
All right. Cool. And yep, I get it. We now have to wait for Apple to actually prove that this works. So this is something that we'll probably get a taste of as people are working with the betas. but we won't really get to see what it does until this fall when the public release is hit and a lot more people are using these services.
You know, I am most excited. As excellent as macOS Siri looks. Mm-hmm. What did I just say? macOS Sierra.
There we go. I wasn't sure if you're talking about Sierra or Siri specifically. Yes, in Sierra.
Siri will be in Sierra. That actually seems like a bad choice now that we actually say this out loud. But whatever. I can't wait. macOS Sierra looks amazing. iOS 10 looks amazing. But I can't wait to get watchOS 3. And unfortunately, I would run the developer preview of watchOS 3 on my Apple Watch, except that it has to be installed from the developer beta of iOS 10. And I don't have a device that I can risk not working.
I totally get that. This is why I am currently not running iOS 10 beta either.
Yeah.
I have Sierra installed, but that's because I can afford to sacrifice my MacBook Air, but not my iPhone.
The old format for doing this would be to install the beta on a partition and just run it separately, but who's got time for that, man?
Right, and that's not an option with your iPhone and Apple Watch.
It's not. It's definitely not an option for iOS devices, and it's really not an option for me on my Mac because I don't really have time to spend on my Mac that I'm not doing production work on.
Right,
my production machines have to be reliable. So I may end up going for the public beta of iOS 10 as soon as it's released, so that I can run that watchOS 3 beta.
All right. Well, you're braver than I am.
Yeah, but we'll have to see.
We'll see.
Reports are that the developer previews are already stable.
Yeah, so I may end up sacrificing my iPhone after the public betas come out. We'll see. Yeah.
We will see, yeah.
Hey, I think we're out of time.
We're over time.
Yeah, that was my nice way of saying, Brian, we're over time. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening.
Let's see, our content written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Every time it's like it's a surprise to me. Our bandwidth is provided by CacheFly, the basis by Boom, recorded just for TMO, and that's all for this week.
Maybe it's you have a little bit of Dory in you, so each week it really is a surprise. Anyhow, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer unless we forget where it is.
Right.
Who are you again?
I forget. That's just what I do. I forget.